Dr. Charles Ping was educated at Rhodes College, Louisville Presbyterian Seminary, and Duke University. For 19 years, he was president of Ohio University. And following his retirement as president, he's been active with the Ping Institute for the Teaching of the Humanities. His achievements and accomplishments are numerous, and we will not list them today. But here at First Presbyterian Church, we've been honored to have Charles and Claire Ping in the life of the church for many years. Dr. Ping's presence might have been intimidating, except for his patience, his kind spirit, and his encouraging nature. So we've been both comforted and honored to have the Pings as members of our congregation, and we look forward to hearing your remarks today, Dr. Ping. Welcome.
Two quick comments before turning to the subject that I was asked to address. First, it's always a mistake to ask someone my age to talk about the past. The past has far more reality for me than the future. I sent the manuscript to Craig, and he said, "Oh, go ahead." Well, I did cut it some, Craig. The second thing is, when I started this, I really realized I was at our cottage in northern Michigan, and I had very limited resources. I had two histories of the church, Mary Conant's carefully detailed account that was published as part of the sesquicentennial, and Peg McGraw's 1998 addition to that. And I had the Thomas Hoover sesquicentennial history of Ohio University, which is very precise and very detailed. And then I had the wonderful, lively, and rich Betty Hollow history that was published during the bicentennial. And my reflection, and here I am in the North Woods, wanting access to the archives to look up and to think about lots of things. Well, some of them are clear. A question: how closely are the histories of the university and this church linked? Well, it seems to me that the best way to answer the question is to stand with me at the foot of College Street where it joins Union and look across the street at the college gate and beyond that to the three buildings in the center of the campus. Cutler on its left, Wilson on its right, McGuffey. Then if you peek around the corner of Chubb Hall, you can just see the edge of Lindley Hall. Drop your eyes and read the quotation from the Northwest Ordinance on the gate: religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. Cutler, Wilson, McGuffey, Lindley, who were they? And what do they and the quotation mean, and why are they so important that they should be placed at the center of the campus? What do the four, as well as the quotation, have to do with the First Presbyterian Church of Athens? The short answer is that the Northwest Ordinance is responsible for their being an Athens as a center for an academy in Ohio, and that three of the four men were both presidents of the university, as you've already heard, and pastors of this church. Indeed, they were the founding presidents and pastors of both the university and the church. But the story's a little more complicated and, I think, interesting than that. The First Amendment to the Constitution reads in part, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or preventing the free exercise thereof." The citizens of this new nation understood and practiced, with some exceptions, the freedom of expression. But the clause, freedom from or prohibition of establishment, is a little harder to understand. What is an establishment? Well, it was clear what it meant when this was actually written. This meant taxes to support churches, and that was forbidden. But beyond that, it had a whole rich variety of interpretations and conflicts, as it turned out. The disestablishment clause has been the subject of such disagreements for over 200 years now. Thomas Jefferson had no such confusion or uncertainty. In 1802, he wrote to the Danbury Baptist Jefferson, and in a letter, Jefferson described the amendment to the Constitution as creating, quote, "a wall of separation." A wall of separation between church and state. He designed the campus of the University of Virginia, developed the curriculum, and established the governance patterns reflecting that conviction of freedom. If you visit the campus, the old part of the campus clearly has as its focal point visually a library, not a chapel, but a library. And there was to be no professor of theology on his faculty because the University of Virginia was a public university. And it was to be supported by the state of Virginia. The wall of separation was not used by the United States Supreme Court until ruling on a case in 1878. More recently, beginning with a series of cases that started in 1948, a wall of separation has become so commonplace that it serves to define the meaning of this particular section of the Constitution. It's a troubling reality to think about it and to try to puzzle about what it means. I think it is a very important concept. Indeed, I would go so far to suggest it may be one of the things that distinguishes this nation from much of the rest of the world. But wall of separation hardly describes the relation between public and private in 1809 when the First Presbyterian Society was organized. Why not? That was the question that really interested me. The language in the prohibition of establishment in the Constitution had been in place for 20 years. The Constitution was adopted, or ratified rather, 20 years before the society was formed. This amendment to the Constitution was deemed so important by some of the colonies that it was a condition of their ratification. Yet the first four presidents of the university, as you've heard repeatedly, were Presbyterian clergymen. All four serve concurrently as pastors of this church. Thomas Hoover, in his sesquicentennial history, writes, "For nearly half a century, the university, while legally a state institution, had been under the control of Presbyterian ministers and church members." By the mid-19th century, the Methodists gained control of the Board of Trustees, and they promptly elected Solomon Howard president, who was, Howard was a Methodist clergyman. He is the longest serving president in the history of the university. He outlasted me by almost a year. And with, interestingly, within 2 years of his appointment, all the faculty were Methodists. Howard was succeeded by another very effective president who was also Methodist. As far as I can determine, the last president prior to my appointment who was also an ordained minister is Isaiah Crook in the late 1890s, a Methodist. 17 of the pastors of this church were either presidents or faculty of the university. Now, that was almost universal in the first three centuries of American higher education. Why? What contributed to this easy acceptance of the linking of religion and state, public and private? Part of the answer is that religion is the very fabric out of which American life was woven. The freedom to exercise clause of the Constitution captures much of the motivation leading to the settlement of this new land. Secondly, the history of the United States is a story of the gradual realization, gradual and incomplete realization, of many of the grand ideals expressed in our founding documents. Jefferson's immortal preamble to the Declaration of Independence proclaims in ringing words that all men are equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, rights that the state can neither give nor take away because they belong to them as human beings, unalienable. Now, Jefferson owned and used human beings as slaves. And by the word man, he certainly did not mean, politically at least, women. It would be 140 years before women gained the right to vote, and even longer before they gained real freedom. Almost two centuries of conflict and struggle passed before America began to offer the equal opportunity and political freedom promised in Jefferson's words. The meaning of language, the language promising religious freedom of religious expression, and the prohibition of the establishment of religion gradually clarified over two centuries. These United States have always been a nation of exalted ideals and aspirations combined with somewhat uneven practice. Much like most of us who profess Christian ideals. A second, or even third reason, rather, is that a third reason that is for the easy acceptance of a linking of religion and state is a simple practical fact of the day, education. This was particularly true for Presbyterians who have had a very long tradition of an educated clergy, a clergy thoroughly educated in the biblical languages, as was true of all Presbyterian ministers at the time. My ordination came only after a thorough examination by the presbytery on my ability to read and interpret the Hebrew and the Greek of the biblical languages. My ordination, therefore, was as what was then called a teaching elder. In our household, Claire is ordained as the ruling elder. Clergymen were commonly the only educated people on the frontier. Therefore, they were the educators. Education was then, as always, at its heart, language. And the use and understanding of language. But the 200 years ago, the study of Greek, Latin, and Hebrew defined language education. In the first decades of the town's existence, while Athens was still an outpost, youth were in fact declining Latin verbs and translating Virgil and Homer in this community. What could be more natural than to have educated clergy lead both an academy for the young and a church? The fourth reason is a little less pleasant. Denominationalism in its most ugly form was rampant in the 19th century and even into the 20th century. Congregational and Presbyterian persuasion dominated when the group met at the Bunch of Great Tavern in 1786 to form the Ohio Company and to petition the Continental Congress for land. And by Cutler's persuasion, the sale contained a provision for required set-aside of two entire townships within the other larger huge grant. That is, a set-aside of 46,080 acres of land. The two townships came to be known as the Athens Township and the Alexander Township. The Presbyterians controlled the company and therefore the land. Cutler drafted in 1800 the first draft of the charter for the university to be established near the center of the land grant, and the Ohio Company accepted the charter. The frame photostatic copy of that handwritten 1800, not 1804, but 1800 draft of the original handwritten document hangs on my wall, a gift of the Massachusetts Alumni Chapter when I retired. And the original is in the archives of Northwestern University, a gift of the Cutler's descendants to the university. When this newly organized state of Ohio chartered the Ohio University, the General Assembly used the very language of Cutler's draft to write the law incorporating the Ohio University. At the time, Presbyterians completely controlled the Board of Trustees and naturally named a Presbyterian minister preceptor for the academy that was a precursor of a university. And he was also the founding pastor of this church. Denominationalism was, as I said earlier, rampant, and it was ugly. And as the states were carved out of the old Northwest Territory, state by state, the denominations decided each had to have their own college to protect the good faith and morals of the young. And if you look at the founding dates of each of the colleges, and there are a bunch of them in Ohio, and you look back in their history to the founding denominations, you see the evidence of this denominationalism. All educational institutions at the time were struggling for students. There simply weren't enough. Ohio University president and pastor, the Reverend Robert Wilson, hired an agent in 1838 to counter the attacks of the agents of denominational colleges and to insist that Ohio, a state institution, was, quote, no less attentive to religion and good morals than other seminaries established by particular denominations. Decades later, faculty records show the faculty discussed two questions. First, the personal piety of the faculty. That should make an interesting discussion. But their second question was, what can be done to lead students to a personal and saving knowledge of Jesus Christ? This is a public university faculty. Ohio's a watershed. To the east, historically, denominational colleges are, in fact, the dominant colleges. To the west, and I don't know which is east and west from here, to the west, public higher education is dominant. The distinction public and private had little force early in American history. The two were intertwined and linked in a variety of ways. Chief Justice John Marshall, in an 1819 opinion on the Dartmouth College case, clearly wrote into law an interpretation of the Constitution in which he made a precise distinction between Dartmouth College, which in his judgment was a private institution, and the legislature of the state of New Hampshire. And in the process, this great Chief Justice overturned for the first time a state Supreme Court decision. It is a clear and precise distinction. The case was largely ignored. And you get into the late 19th century before it even begins to be explored. Jefferson had it right from the start. A public institution is an institution supported by tax funds, and therefore it should be kept separate from religion. There's a fifth and final reason I found in my reading for some similarities between the history of the university and this church. As I read the published histories, it occurred to me that I was hearing some of the same names over and over, both individuals and family names. And I suspect if we put a list of choir roles and Sunday school teachers and elders and deacons and so forth side by side with the university roster, we would see immediately an overlap. Discipline, interestingly, was a problem for both of them. And it was a constant preoccupation of the session and the Board of Trustees. In those days, members were called before the elders, and students were called before the trustees to confess a variety of sins. Public confession was one of the early forms of sanction for both church members and students. And not surprisingly, the use and abuse of alcohol was the most common charge. Money to fund operation, money to repair building, money to shore up leaking roofs were a constant common concern. The condition of structure, the push for new buildings, funds to repair existing buildings. Such cries echo in the minutes of both governing bodies. If such pleading had not been so much a part of my own life and hurt so much, I could have laughed out loud at some of the accounts. William Henry Scott was a graduate of the university and a Methodist minister, and he was Ohio president from 1872 to 1883. He fought hard for state aid. His pleas were soundly rejected, and he reported to the board, "The opposition discouraged hope of obtaining aid in any form from the state." But he continued prophetically, "The time will come when the demand for undenominational education will compel the endorsement of state institutions." In 1881, the Ohio legislature provided $20,000 to repair some of the collapsing buildings on the Ohio University campus. In 1882, Scott, however, resigned to assume the presidency of the recently established Agricultural and Mechanical College in Columbus. Music was important in the life of both, and collaboration between the two strengthened then and now the impact of music both on the campus and the church. The nurture of the young was the heart and the soul of the life of both communities. Interestingly, one of the ways I discovered that their history diverges sharply is in numbers. The church grew rapidly in membership from the start. The university struggled for students. By the time the Reverend John Pratt was arguing that the session should stop pew rent in the 1860s, the membership of the church was far greater than the enrollment in the university. The university was also touched by the revivals that tended to quicken the life and increase the membership of the church. We good, staid Presbyterians had revivals in that period of time, and it produced a great outpouring of new members. President McGuffey expressed to the church his gratitude for a recent revival and for the, quote, outpouring of the Spirit manifest in the deportment of students. With Halloween coming, maybe what we need to do is have a revival, Craig. Rapid growth in enrollment of the university, first with the establishment of normal schools to train teachers in the late 19th and early 20th century, and some years later with a tidal wave of students returning, servicemen returning from the war, impacted the church almost as much as the university. The growth contributed directly to the wonderful years of Pastor Fred Lukes. Fred was a gifted preacher, attracting hordes of students and national recognition. The church was forced to go to three services every Sunday, all of which were filled to accommodate the response. Evelyn Lukes, the pastor's wife, a talented leader and speaker in her own right, was the first woman trustee of Ohio University. The increases in campus enrollment and a surging interest of faith on the part of the young contributed to a dramatic expansion of the Westminster Fellowship. The Athens Presbyterian Church had long led the way for the community in youth groups, Boy Scouts, and youth activities. But the growth of the Westminster Foundation was an impressive culmination of that activity. By 1960, it was a large, virtually independent enterprise. And by 1960, the world had begun to change. Change rapidly, too rapidly for either the university or the church to absorb. The church and the campus were caught up in the social issues of poverty, race, women's rights, and war. Women's organizations had long filled and flourished the church. Then and now, the social ministry of the church reflected their presence. Women, by 1920, were the year they won the vote, were already a majority of the undergraduate students in the university as they are today. Throughout the 200-year history of the two communities, there has been a deeply convicted social activism, serving the poor and the hungry, and welcoming into their ranks early on a few minorities. One of the proud moments in the life of Ohio University is the 1828 commencement oration of John Newton Templeton, The Claims of Liberia. He was followed a few years later by another African-American student, Edward J. Royce, who didn't graduate, but he went on to become the fifth president of Liberia. We don't really know much about Templeton's life as a student at the university, but we do know that he lived in the 1820s in the home of President Pastor Wilson, who it makes, and it seems reasonable, therefore, to assume that he was, in fact, participating in the church. In Peg McDraw's history, she talks about an Alonzo Ridgway, who was welcomed into the family of church members, and who served the church so well and in so many different ways that in the 1920s he was named pastor's aide. President Robert Wilson, also Pastor Wilson, in the 1820s and 30s was an ardent activist in social causes, particularly abolition. He was also an outspoken temperance advocate. He is, in fact, one of my heroes. And he served as president pastor in a time of turmoil and transition in America. Our society struggled then and now to realize the meaning of the declaration that all are equal. A century later, another activist pastor, the Reverend Kimberly, would lead the Athens church in a second period of conflict and redefinition of American society. That period left indelible marks on both the church and the campus. Both would be split by the conflicts, with members leaving the church and the campus forcefully closed by National Guardsmen with bayonets fixed. One of the unique resources I had in my reflections on the university and the church in Athens was a personal letter, an 11-page transcript of an audio tape made by the Reverend Thomas Nichols. Some of you in this congregation may still remember Tom and Betty. We were classmates and very close friends. And Claire and I and Tom and Betty lived through all the rigors of married student housing, including sharing a kitchen and a refrigerator in the basement. Anyway, at the height of the turmoil of the 1960s, following the presentation to the session of a petition signed by 140 members, a petition protesting the church's leadership, Tom had long, painful conversations with the leaders of both sides of the division in the church. The tape describes the response of the community and the impact of the experience of the next few days on the life of Tom Nichols. For he announced to the church that he, after talking with people on both sides, that he would launch a prayer, vigil, and fasting in the church. And I called Tom and talked at length about those years, the conflicts and their impact on the church and the university. He was a graduate student at the university as well as the head of the Westminster Foundation. He sent me a copy, and I read his deeply personal account with tears in my eyes for my friend and for myself, recalling those years here and on other campuses. Tom's account is very honest, searching, and spiritual, as anyone who knows Tom would assume. His biblical references, his soul-searching confessions and his witness are powerful beyond anything I can describe. During these 3 days and nights that the vigil went on, church members from this congregation and other congregations came into the sanctuary. Students and faculty and staff and even the president of the university came and meditated or spoke as they chose. Tom describes the instance of a church member giving him a cup of cold water. It was a silent, as he describes it, an unconscious symbol of how love and compassion can be set free even in a conflicted group. Tom awoke from a sound sleep on the floor in front of the communion table to find a friend and a colleague praying beside him. It was, as he describes it, a gift of grace. When the vigil was over, Tom asked the group if they would have a communion service. And after discussion, they decided that even without the breaking of bread or the taking of the wine, they had had a communion service. So Tom poured the wine out on the ground, and he testified that the elements had been consecrated by the tears, the suffering, and the prayers of this people. Broken but not fully healed, together not fully reconciled, American society, the church, and the university move on to their third century. Out of many does come one for our nation, our university, and our church. A lasting outcome of this period was and is the beginning of the realization of the full significance of this ideal, that all men are created free and equal and all have the protection of the Constitution. The constitutional guarantee of freedom of expression of religion has been found sound. The guarantee of a complete disestablishment of religion, a wall of separation, is an ideal still in the process of being realized. One of the triumphs of the countless lawsuits and the endless discussion is our gradual realization of the importance of Jefferson's wall of separation. This ideal measures the actual and finds the present reality markedly better as a 200-year history of the church and the university document. But the meaning of the ideal and its realization is still subject to disagreement. Let me conclude on a personal note. Claire and I have been part of this congregation for 34 of its 200 years. We are deeply grateful for your care and your nurture and the glorious music of our organists and our choir. We rejoice in the ministries of the four pastors we have known well, Lauren Kreider, John Free, Tom Fisher, and now Craig Seitz. You enrich our faith. During those same years, it's been our privilege to serve the university. For almost two decades as the 18th president of the university, and more recently as a full-time and then part-time faculty member. Some of the years were difficult. All of them were good, though none were easy. But always Claire and I have felt supported by this church. At the same time, I have, by conviction and practice, tried to keep the two spheres, the church and the university, completely separate, however much they may be joined in my heart and my life. Thank you.
We're going to take just a very brief break where you can stretch, and then we'll be ready to move into our commissioned piece of music. So let's stretch for just a few minutes, and then we'll be ready to move on.